Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. These are, by some measure, the earliest days of occupation. Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party have lost their hold on power in Iraq. At this moment, it seems more like the citizens are in control, with their cartloads of computer bits, sinks, and ceiling fans being hauled out of all the government buildings. Saddam Hussein and his Republican Guard are nowhere to be seen. Iraqis with sledgehammers have toppled the gigantic statue of Saddam that once loomed over Firdaus Square. U.S. Marines and the 3rd Infantry seem to be the only people in Baghdad wearing uniforms today. Months ago, when this day was but a gleam in the eye of the U.S. administration, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, was talking about historical models for a post-Saddam occupation.
Should it come to that, we would have an obligation, really, to put in place a better regime. And we are obviously doing contingency planning. And there are lots of different models from history that one could look at. Japan, Germany, but I wouldn't say that anything has been settled upon.
That's Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking some months ago about thoughts at that time for what would happen in Iraq. And it's certainly not a situation that's completely settled at this point either. In this hour, we'll hear what the Pentagon's saying about its plans for reconstruction in Iraq. And then we'd like to look back at the end of World War II. We want to see what lessons, if any, the U.S. occupations in Japan and Germany might have for Iraq. Connection listeners, we'd like to hear your thoughts on U.S. occupation, where you see the useful parallels in history. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I want to start with Pamela Hess, who's been on the program before, covering the Pentagon for United Press International. She's with us right now. Hi, Pamela.
Hi.
Tell me what you're hearing from the generals or the briefers when they're talking about what comes next in Iraq.
The official briefings in Qatar and at the Pentagon haven't focused a great deal on what happens next. They're trying to be careful not to get out ahead of themselves. They think that they still have some combat work to do. Mm-hmm. The war isn't done yet, so they don't want to go there. We have, however, had a chance to talk with General Garner. I'm sorry, retired General Garner, who was in 1991 and 92 in charge of Operation Provide Comfort, which was providing humanitarian relief to Kurds in northern Iraq after the war. General Garner is now in Kuwait, and he is in charge of the civil administration. He'll be operating under General Franks, but probably actually under Lieutenant General McKiernan, who would be the guy on the ground in Baghdad keeping security in the country so that reconstruction can begin.
So the idea that General Tommy Franks would go in, that's not likely to happen?
Franks has 25 nations under his purview. To pull him off to do specifically Iraq security is not really a good use of his time. He's the U.S. Central Commander, so he would probably delegate this to the guy just under him, which is Lieutenant General McKiernan, who's been in charge of all of the ground troops, the ground operations.
Are they saying anything, or have they said anything, Pamela, about how long a U.S. military occupation might last in Iraq?
Behind the scenes, the longest I've heard is 2 years. Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary, said this weekend as long as 6 months. The feeling here, when the Bush administration came in, they wanted out of nation building. They wanted out of peacekeeping. It hasn't exactly worked out that way. They kind of keep getting into it. But their focus here is they want to get the ball rolling in Iraq and then kind of wash their hands of it, at least from day-to-day administration. They know that setting up an entirely new country, a new government, is a huge task. They want to get things started and then put it in the hands of the people that are there. And I think it's not necessarily because, you know, they're sort of pie-eyed idealists that believe that, you know, the democracy should be in the hands of the Iraqis or, for that matter, the Afghan people, mm-hmm. but simply that it's such a big job and so much can go wrong with it. They don't want it on their plate.
Although there does seem to be almost an eagerness to get that process started. If I think back to what I've heard from the Secretary of State, from the Secretary of Defense, even from the President himself over the last week.
Yes, they do really want to get this process started. The strategic reason is because the sooner they get a friendly government in there, the sooner they'll be able to go around, hunt for weapons of mass destruction, root out any terrorist groups that they think might be in Iraq and sort of chalk this one up as a huge threat to the United States in their view, that now no longer exists that way. So they want to get started. And they have incredibly ambitious plans, and it's amazing what they have planned. But whether or not you're going to see Americans there a year from now running the various ministries, I just don't think that's going to happen.
Pamela, thanks so much for helping us with this.
Sure.
Pamela Hess covers the Pentagon for UPI. I'd like to turn to two people now who have that longer perspective. John Dower is a professor of Japanese history at MIT. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Embracing Defeat, Japan in the Wake of World War II. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Charles Mayer is professor of European history at Harvard. He's an expert on Germany during and after World War II. Among his books are The Unmasterable Past, History, Holocaust, and German National Identity. Charles, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Now, I'm not going to put you both on the spot and say, what should Powell do and what should the president do? Because I think that so much of the conversation that we've had on this program and at coffee tables and cocktail parties around the country is, oh, yes, people talk about Japan and people talk about Germany. And I'd like to tap into your knowledge about what exactly did happen back at that time. So perhaps we can talk about what was similar in those two countries. And as we get on in the program, we'll talk about what makes them distinct. They were both occupied by the U.S. military in the months after the end of the Second World War. Were there other things, John, that made Germany and Japan similar in your view?
I think the differences are greater than the similarities, but Japan was a country that had been ruled by a very repressive and militaristic regime. It had suffered shattering destruction in the course of the war, more so probably than we see in Iraq. But once we get beyond that, the differences are probably greater than the similarities.
Charles, what would you have to say about that?
Well, I would stress the differences between Germany and Iraq. We came to Germany in 1945 believing that most Germans had been indoctrinated by Nazism. So it was not a mission necessarily of liberation. It was a mission of democratization that we wanted to carry out. It took, of course, we were there 4 years, progressively giving institutions back to the Germans, I'd say at least until 1947, though we were in control. It was a very complicated, long prepared for mission. And the premises were much different about the nature of the societies.
I want to ask you both to respond to a couple of quotes that I found in notes about those occupations after the Second World War from the Yalta Conference, a U.S. position paper outlining what should be provided to the Germans, and it reads as follows: the lowest standards of health, diet, and shelter compatible with the prevention of disease and disorder, a rock-bottom standard of living for the Germans. That's what the Americans said ought to be provided, and in fact, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, Henry Morgenthau, said the German people as a whole must have it driven home to them that the whole nation has been engaged in a lawless conspiracy. There was a strong element, was there not, in both these occupations of punishment?
I think that that's true. There was a notion that they should stew in their own juices and suffer for their sins, but I think the other side of that was an extremely idealistic vision of genuine democratization. And that very quickly, in the case of Japan, became dominant. And there had been long planning for what to do in Japan after the war.
But those two seem so incompatible, John.
Well, I think it's because governments have different voices. Henry Morgenthau was a very punitive voice, and there were other people who went in and said, look, you know, these people were led by bad leaders, but now is the chance to really teach them and give them the opportunity to have a life, create a life of their own. But it was a very long thought out plan. You must remember that in the case of certainly Japan, the Americans began thinking of the occupation after Pearl Harbor, 1942. So for several years, they got committees working on this. In the last years of the war, they're preparing enormous numbers of studies and plans of what to do. Quite a different situation than we see now. And very quickly, when they moved into Japan, the slogans were demilitarization and democratization. That very quickly became the plan, and it was a very idealistic, progressive plan in the framework of an emerging new international order. Very different, I think, from the plan-as-you-go type of thinking that we're seeing now in the case of the current conflict.
Charles Mayer, the plans for reconstruction in Germany, do they go back to before D-Day? Were there people talking and thinking about that then?
No, I mean, I think we considered these countries as a pair in many ways. We had a school for civil administrators in Charlottesville. Plans were being drawn up from our entry into the war for reconstruction of this country. It's worth remembering, after all, about what you cited about the lowering of living standards. Germany had conquered most of Europe. It had been living off much of conquered Europe. There was little sympathy. The current Iraqi regime was a threat. It was articulated as a threat because of its possession of weapons of mass destruction. We see Saddam's, the Iraqi people as Saddam's major victims once he was repulsed from Kuwait. This was not the case. Europeans outside Germany and European Jews had been Hitler's victims. So they started with a much greater feeling of anger against German people. But as John said, as in Japan, the program quickly changed. Democratization, denazification, decartelization, as it was then conceived, were all part of the program. And there was an institutional enthusiasm, a notion about being able to rebuild, some of which is there now, but I think with less preparation for the task at home, perhaps.
Does that mean that the U.S. military occupiers after the Second World War had a claim on a sort of automatic legitimacy as a country that had suffered at the hands of the Japanese and the Germans? And I know they shared the role with other Allied powers in Germany, but did the U.S. military occupiers have a freer hand as a result?
I think the issue of legitimacy is absolutely central to current debates. In the case of Japan, the occupation had, dominated by the Americans, had both moral and legal legitimacy in the eyes of virtually everyone, certainly in the eyes of this Allied coalition, certainly in the eyes of all of Japan's neighbors who had been savaged by Japan, and in the eyes of the great majority of Japanese people, because Japan had declared war on the United States. Japan had accepted the surrender terms. Japan had agreed to unconditional surrender and occupation. And the emperor himself had announced the surrender and then appeared very quickly standing side by side with the supreme commander.
More legitimacy in Germany as well, Charles?
This is unclear to me. And there was no emperor figure to continue in Germany. We wanted the Nazis out of there. They fled. Those scenes are not unlike what's happening in Baghdad today. Top Nazis trying to surrender, some committing suicide, some just fleeing. A military government as a residual legatee to sign the capitulation. So there was legitimacy, I think, for the American occupation, and Germans soon came to welcome the Americans. We behaved pretty well. The question of the coalition was an interesting one. We headed, after all, the UN took its name from the name of the Allied coalition. One point, if I can just add, which I think is worth stressing, when we came into Germany, we knew that there was a long tradition of, after all, constitutional government that had preceded the Nazis. There were liberals, if not over Democrats.
There was a multi-party system that there could be re-energized. I have to stop you there, if you don't mind, Charles, because we're taking a brief break. Connection listeners, two perhaps of this nation's ranking experts on U.S. military occupation after the Second World War, and a chance for you to join our conversation about what lessons from that time apply today. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Charles Mayer. He's professor of history at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, editor of The Marshall Plan and Germany, and an expert on Germany during and after the Second World War. John Dower is also with us. He's a professor of Japanese history at MIT, an expert on post-World War II Japan, and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Embracing Defeat, Japan in the Wake of World War II. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation about U.S. military occupation and the lessons of some 50-odd years ago as we see them today. John Dower, the title of your book, Embracing Defeat, says something about the way that the Japanese regarded the U.S. military occupation. Were they welcomed? Was there a sense of acquiescence or agreement to the whole idea of being occupied?
The book title, Embracing Defeat, is somewhat nuanced and a little suggestive, in, I hope, in a certain way. No one welcomes being defeated, but I use the concept because there was in Japan at the end of the war a real sense of liberation, and the first sense of liberation was of being liberated from death, because the Japanese...
Death at the hands of the Americans?
Death at the hands of the Americans, because by the end of the war... around 3 million people of a population of 70 million were dead as a result of World War II in Japan. 66 cities culminating in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were pulverized. And the Japanese had been told they should fight to the bitter end. So there was a sense that the death has stopped. We can start over. And in fact, the relief at the end of this prolonged war, which had been going on since the 1930s, beginning in China, was palpable. And the Americans moved in with the support of an intact Japanese government. The Japanese government structures remained intact. Everyone was in place. When the Americans moved in, and I think that we should keep this in mind, there was not a single incident of terror or violence against the American forces.
In all the time of the military
occupation. In all
the time.
And this is a country that had been launching suicide attacks, of course, in the form of the kamikaze in the last year of the war. And then the Americans moved in not knowing what to expect. The photos we have of the earliest days are immediately of GIs moving very comfortably among the populace, very comfortably from a very early date. And this sense of security, that there were no outside countries angered by this, that there were no outside people that might come into the country, that there were no forces within Japan, elements within Japan that might really resent this or feel that this was a violation of sacred soil, led to a security in which the Americans could concentrate from almost the moment they got in on democratization.
I'm going to turn to Charles in just half a sec, but a clarification from you. Did the Japanese people in 1945 believe that their life would be better under General MacArthur than it had been under the sort of warrior culture that led them into combat?
I think there was a sense it couldn't have been worse, because until the moment the war ended, you'd had no idea whether your loved ones would be killed or you yourself would die, and so it couldn't have been worse.
Charles Mayer, would you say that there are any similarities in Germany? The situation a little more complicated, I suppose.
I guess every situation a historian sees is always more complicated. But certain similarities. Yes, Germany had been pulverized from the air. 500,000 Germans were killed in air raids, a country of around 75 million, including Austria. 4 million soldiers, when they counted up, would be dead or missing. These were huge losses. People were exhausted from the air war. I think they were happy to surrender. And it's important to remember they were happy to surrender to Americans or British rather than Russians. This was an invasion which brought the Russians in. The Russians had fought in Japan, the Japanese war, only for a week and really in Manchuria. But the Russians, after all, had borne the brunt of the land war since 1941. And I think the Germans felt they were getting a better deal with the Americans, or would get a gentler deal with the Americans. But there was one point of an army of occupation. It's no accident, in a certain sense, that there are no attacks. An army of occupation has to keep its friends from being assassinated by sore losers, in part. Germany had had a lot of street fighting and some assassination before in the breakdown of the Weimar Republic. Japan had had assassinations in the late 30s. This tradition had to be wiped out, and an army of occupation is there just as the most basic level, in part, to help the good guys, if it can find them, prevail during the next couple of years. That's going to take a while.
And we see evidence of that falling apart in Afghanistan with the number of assassination attempts that there have been on the regime that has been put into power. There, I'm even thinking of the assassination attempt on the Serbian prime minister, just because it's a fragile regime coming after a period of prolonged conflict and unrest.
Right, and inner conflict, even before the wars, conflict, very bitter political conflict, maybe less so in Japan, but certainly in Germany.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin. Jim's joining us on the phone. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling.
I'd like to just make a couple of points about why Japan succeeded so well, and then we can kind of compare that with Iraq. I think very quickly, by the U.S. preserving Emperor Hirohito's status and waiving his war responsibility, kind of got the ball rolling. Another key to success was the occupation was of Japan, in that the U.S. was prepared to play the role of the good winner opposite Japan's good loser. And this also saw occupational reforms like labor unions, land reform, women's right to vote. So you had a constituency there. And the third part is another critical pillar was Japan's comeback was that San Francisco Peace Treaty, which was designed by the U.S. to bind them into a relationship of trust and reconciliation. And so it gave them a chance to come into the mainstream.
You've been doing your homework, Jim. I wonder if you would mind if I drew from that the point that you make about land reform in Japan, because it, certainly in John's writing, that's a central part of winning the good loser, good winner thing, winning the confidence of people in part by creating a better society for those people who didn't have access to land and property. Is that reasonable?
Well, what Jim has said is very suggestive in two ways. One, he referred to the San Francisco Peace Treaty and the end of the occupation, and that reminds us that the occupation of Japan took 6.5 years. And I think we really should keep this in mind. We're now hearing projections about, depending on who you listen to, we'll be out of there in 6 months. The American forces will be out in 6 months if you listen to Wolfowitz. We may be there as long as 2 years. Well, we were there 6.5 years in the case of Japan in a real occupation, and the troops are still there today.
Was there an acknowledgement at the time that it was going to take 5-6 years, or were they also saying back in 1945 we'll be out in a few
months? It always
began,
we'll be out soon, and in fact the real when it began, well, it was same as today. You know, we're not quite sure. We should be out in a couple of years, and Americans were planning. General MacArthur, who was the head of the occupation, had very high aspirations to be nominated as Republican candidate for president in the 1948 elections, and so he frequently used the target of 1947, so which the subtext was, I'll be ready to come back now and lead the the reconstruction of America. In the interim, and I think that this gets us to one of the important aspects of the occupation of Japan, that policy of democratization and demilitarization entailed not simply eliminating the Japanese military, but introducing a really radical progressive agenda of reform across the board, which included a land reform that essentially dispossessed the landlord class in the countryside and freed up a heavily burdened, largely tenant population. We introduced radical labor reforms. Very interesting to contemplate that going on in
the latter years of the New Deal, in many ways.
Well, this is exactly right. What happened is that the people who were in Japan and implementing policy came out of the New Deal liberal left tradition in America. And MacArthur, a conservative, was in fact supporting many of these policies, that there should be economic democratization. There should be, labor should have a major voice. There should be land reform. Major, major reform was to establish a new constitution for Japan, which was established popular sovereignty and a very strong agenda of civil rights.
Jim, let me just go back to you if I can, because you had made a reference to Iraq, and I'd stepped on you before you got to that.
Yes, and here's, I think, the rub. You know, especially after the events in Afghanistan, many conclude that the U.S. is not in the nation-building business. The other part is, what we do not want to do this multilaterally in concert with our friends and allies and the United Nations. And you contrast this with the thousands of Americans who underwent, you know, during World War II, program of historical training and linguistic training of Japan, the Fulbright, and all these other cultural links that were forged with Japan. And here,
are you saying, Jim, that the United States does not have the wherewithal to mount the sort of occupation in Iraq that it was prepared to do after the Second World War?
Yes, but perhaps the resolve. We have the technology, the infrastructure, but it seems like this administration, perhaps even the last, is not interested in going down that avenue.
It certainly, Charles Mayer, has so much to do with the economy in Germany as well. Was it you who used the word decartelization earlier? That's
yes.
Again, the same. It's not land reform, but it's the same principle of loosening some of the economic controls and reorganizing the nation's economy.
Well, two points or a couple of points to be made. First of all, the task in Germany was seen as one of reconstituting, not nation building, but rebuilding perhaps a nation that had gone wrong. And it was thought at the time that economic institutions were crucial to that effort. There was less of a peasant class in Germany. It was more thoroughly industrialized. The notion was, though, and it was a notion that had been involved in the Weimar Republic and in the New Deal by theorists, many social democrats, that economic concentration and monopolies led to fascism. The idea would be that you would break these up in Germany, as briefly we had tried to do in the New Deal at home, that was seen as a much worse problem in Germany. These efforts, in fact, were the least successful, probably, of the occupation. We certainly reintroduced political democratization that's worked very well. We initially broke up cartels like IG Farben, the chemical trust, some of the steel companies, but they gradually got together again under different auspices, and we gradually, certainly in the later years of the Truman administration, came to think that this was less urgent a task. And in fact, as the Cold War became more pressing, we shied away from what we then considered to be left-wing reforms. I think this was probably the area of least success, but it was a very ambitious notion.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Jim, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Raleigh, North Carolina. Roger's joining us now. Hi, Roger.
Hi there. I was since the perception of our motives are extremely important for the reaction of our plans, I was wondering if Japan and Germany reconstruction leaders were as heavily embedded into corporations and boards of directors as we are today.
Who's first on that, John?
Well, one of the striking things today is the extreme economic importance of Iraq in the eyes of many people in the world, and certainly in the eyes of many Americans. Japan had the rather ironic good luck of being a resource-poor country, which also was not seen at the end of World War II as having a major economic future. So there were no outside interests clamoring to get in to get hold of oil, private or state interests. And one of the very striking differences, I think, was that the reconstruction of this shattered country was done from within Japan. Now, the whole phenomenon now of who is going to get the reconstruction contracts to rebuild Iraq, and well, it's certainly not going to be the French, you can be sure of that, you know, and so on. This whole game, which really is going to have profound ideological and political ramifications, because it looks like war profiteering and carpetbagging in the eyes of many, this was simply absent. And in fact, when they were started to try to rebuild Japan in, after the initial reformist phase, the Americans were hard-pressed to persuade Americans to get involved in Japan, because they still didn't see in the late 40s and even early 50s an economic future for the company. The whole intervention of outside economic interests, which will get compounded with internal politics and be potentially corrupting, was not present. to about, any significant degree
what
in Japan.
What about references to the Marshall Plan, 1947? I mean, does that serve as any kind of a mirror for what we're watching in Iraq? Because certainly there was money to be made there.
But the money was not really a primary consideration, I don't think. What we got out of Germany in economic terms was the reestablishment of some contractual relationships. After all, there were American firms in Germany. We got patents, which we could sometimes exploit usefully. But in general, I think Germany was seen as a drain on our resources. It didn't have oil to export. Its coal was for domestic uses.
So much, Charles, was put in. I guess what I'm wondering whether or not there were corporate interests in the United States who expected to get something back from that, or was it
Well, I don't think they expected to get anything extraordinarily back from that. In the Marshall Plan, not for Germany alone, for 16 European countries,
right,
the American public purse paid American firms to export critical materials to Europe. That was bit more business as usual, you could say, with a slight public contractual relationship and not exploitation in that sense. I don't think carpetbagging was – there were some instances, but it was not a real problem or expectation.
We talk about the economic situation in Japan, John. We look at the early 50s before there was any kind of connection of this country to the rest of the global economy, I suppose.
Well, Japan until – one of the things I think that we have to keep in mind for Japan and for the present day is the extraordinary misery of ordinary people. They used to have little man-in-the-street radio programs in Japan. It was said the most common question up until 1948 or so, 3 years after the war, was how did you eat yesterday? In other words, how could you survive? How did you get through each day? You had rampant, you had starvation. You had, in Japan, there were people in 1948, people were still dying of starvation or freezing in the railroad stations in the winters.
I need to stop you there. We have to step away for a short break. We'll continue when we come back. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. It is a time when the planners in the Pentagon and other places in Washington are beginning to think about what comes next in Iraq, and we're looking at the situation in Japan and in Germany after the Second World War for lessons about U.S. military occupation. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, on the day that crowds are running through the streets of Baghdad proclaiming the end of the Ba'ath Party regime, we're talking about lessons of U.S. military occupation from the Second World War. And we'll go straight back to our telephones from Chatham County, North Carolina. Nick's joining us now. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is that our rehabilitation of the German economic system through things like the Marshall Plan really didn't kick in until it was obvious that an economically prostrate Germany would be an incredible liability in the Cold War that was developing with the Russians at that time. And I'm wondering if your listeners see a political motive of similar strength to get us to rehabilitate Iraq.
It's certainly in the writing that both Charles Mayer's done about Germany and John Dower about Japan, it comes back time and time again. The idea that whatever was going to happen, Charles, perhaps I can start with you, whatever was going to happen within that U.S. military occupation had as much to do with the neighbors of Germany as it did with Germany itself. Is that fair?
Yes. I mean, and the neighbors were part of the coalition. The one neighbor had an occupation zone, France. Nick's point is correct. we changed our concepts about Germany's economic role. At first, we thought Germany should just be kept down, and the French were, of course, somewhat sympathetic to this view. This became impossible. You couldn't feed Germany if you kept it down, and we soon came to the notion we had to reconstruct it, and the justification for the Marshall Plan 2.5 years later or so was precisely the Cold War, but the burden of economic burden and the folly of not using these productive resources. What we tried to assure the French, Belgians, and other neighbors was that although we would let Germany recover and help Germany to recover economically, we would not let it recover an army militarily. But within another 2 years, that resolution had been dissipated by virtue of the Korean War, the threat to the East. So step by step, and this was the achievement of American diplomacy, we reassured neighbors that Germany would be safe. And what part of the reassurance was, of course, we had to stay there. Whether as an occupation force or as later as a NATO force. So it was a very creative period, I think, of diplomacy and reconstruction.
Certainly through the 50s and early 60s, when the wall went up, that was a time when everybody acknowledged that Germany was a key bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Sure. It had the only army in being on the continent once we created it. The French were off in Indochina and then in Algeria. So it was crucial. But by then, it was clear that Germany had been remade. One fretted particularly, and periodically there were all these books, is Germany really democratic? Will it go Nazi again? But in fact, by the early 50s, I think most people discounted this danger.
And John, the Japanese had done so much to alienate all their neighbors in the 15 years leading up to the military occupation.
They certainly had. They were much despised and hated. And it was very necessary to persuade the world around them that they were not going to be a menace. Again, I would like to pick up on a couple of things in Nick's point and what Charlie has said. It's really appropriate to think not of the occupation of Japan, but two different occupations of Japan, because where strategic interests were paramount, the Americans did not pursue democratization. And in the case of Japan, they simply lopped off the southern part of Japan, Okinawa, and turned that from the very beginning into a military base. And the reforms that we're talking about took place in the rest of Japan, mm-hmm. whereas Okinawa simply became what can only be described as a grotesque appendage of the American military empire. It did not get sovereignty returned to it in the San Francisco Peace Treaty that our caller from Madison spoke about. It remained a colony of the U.S. until 1972, and it remains today one of the poorest and most distorted of American prefectures, which is overwhelmingly dominated by the American military bases. Where strategic considerations were from the beginning paramount, you did not have a serious pursuit of democratization. In the case of the rest of Japan, you had a breathing spell, because while the Americans were concentrating on Europe and the Marshall Plan, they weren't paying so much attention to Japan, and MacArthur and his staff had 2 years to really push democratization. Then, of course, the Chinese are emerging, clearly are going to moving toward victory in China, the people that were working on the Marshall Plan, like George Kennan and others, come to Japan and say, "What are you doing? You've got to get rid of this democratization. We've got paramount security. You guys are too radical. We've got to rehabilitate the old guard. We've got to bring back the old interests. We've got to build up Japan as a bulwark against communism in Asia." It was that period where they could really concentrate, that breathing space where they could concentrate on real, genuine democratization and the infrastructures in which Japanese people could then operate and really sink deep the roots. That was very crucial.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. Nick, thanks for that. And we're next to Raleigh, North Carolina. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hey, good morning.
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I wanted to ask your guest to comment, please, on what I see as a major problem with the future of Iraq, and that is the geostrategic context of the nation states, Japan and Germany versus Iraq in their democratization and reform. After World War II, the neighbors of Japan, China, Philippines, Korea, they were only too happy to see not only demilitarization but democratization and reform of Japan, because they saw Japan as a dangerous, hostile, aggressive nation. Germany, likewise, France.
But at one level, David, couldn't you say that the Saudis and the Iranians and perhaps even the Jordanians are happy to see the end of Saddam Hussein?
To some extent, but I think you have to see Iraq in the greater geostrategic context as being in the Muslim world, a world that viewed the Iraqi war not only as a war to depose Hussein, but a war to conquer Muslimism, to defeat Islam, and they may not be so interested in seeing a true reform and democratization of Iraq.
All right, let me start with Charles Mayer on that. The idea that there's still some confusion about exactly what the occupation is about. I don't know whether or not, David, that's a fair characterization of it, but people aren't really, the neighbors aren't sure. In fact, much of the rest of the world is not sure. Does that make it that much more difficult?
Well, I think the caller's point is absolutely correct. Germany was surrounded by democracies, countries that had been largely democratic before a fascist interlude. It had itself enjoyed some democracy. We are going into a region where there is no democracy, really. Perhaps, and assuming we're not counting Israel, I think the rulers in these countries are looking at what will happen with a great deal of ambiguity and trepidation, because they may sit uneasily themselves in Syria, Saudi Arabia, even in Egypt. Turkey is the country which has the most robust democracy. And we have to ask, are we really ready for democracy if it brings to power people we don't like? Remember, democracy had brought the Nazi movement to within an inch of power in Germany in the early 1930s, and then before the takeover. If democracy means the victory of anti-democratic forces or fundamentalist forces or however you wish to define it, it's going to be a dicey situation for us. And hopefully, I think we believe, I don't know, I'm not privy to the administration's thought, that somehow we will be empowering a gradualistic change in Syria and in Saudi Arabia and forcing these countries toward an evolution that can be contained. You know, inshallah, as they might say there, I hope, would to God, because it can easily get out of control.
Well, I think David has put his finger on something that brings us almost full circle to legitimacy, a question that we began the conversation with. If you think of the Middle East before this present war, many of us would say one of the great problems in the Middle East is occupied areas, and specifically the problem of Israel and the occupied territories, and this intractable cycle of violence that took it. And our resolution, and another trigger to September 11th was, of course, bin Laden's sense of an American occupation and forces present in Saudi Arabia that violated the integrity of the East and of Islamic things. Our response to this has been to now put ourselves in the situation of creating another occupied area in the Middle East, in which America, who has really squandered the goodwill and trust of much of the world, not simply Islamic fundamentalists, but allies and friends of America who have been appalled by the unilateral and arrogant way in which the America plowed ahead, so that whether that's right or wrong, there's going to be an enormous sense that here's a new occupation, here's a new regime, America's playing the role of an occupation power. We've seen this with the British setting up regimes that are going to, you know, the British setting up Iraq back in the 20s. And so that sense of mistrust of the Americans being there compounds the situation profoundly and creates security issues that are going to make focus on reconstruction very difficult.
All right, David, thank you very much for that call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Charles, in your writing about the U.S. occupation of Germany, you talk about two stages of occupation. You talk about the sort of practical application of political, you know, whatever could be put in place to denazify the country, to go through the war crimes trials, to release the political prisoners. These are all practical things that can be done. But then you talk about a second stage, a sort of inner form of democracy, if I get your words correctly. And I'm wondering whether or not that kind of second stage is a crucial thing for us to talk about when we consider the type of occupation that might occur in Iraq, the actual persuasion of people that whatever is being done is in their best interests.
Well, yes, this took a long time. I would, in fact, say very briefly, three stages: policing, denazification, war crimes trials, then around 1947 to 49, institution building,
yes,
parliaments, a constitution, parallel to much of what was happening in Japan.
Okay, we're four years into it now.
Yes, and then we're 4 years. But then a real stage of what I would call inner democratization. Germans accepted Western political forms they had earlier. They weren't really convinced that they were the best. There was no other choice, especially as the world was dividing into communism and American-led democracy. It's only, I think, with the 1950s, later 50s and 60s, that you have what might be called the real winning of hearts and minds, where people became convinced Democrats. It required, in part, a new generation of younger people who'd been to America and seen Americans in operation and got a taste of my friends and colleagues who are nearing retirement now. It required, in part, the convulsions of a student movement. It required, in part, finally, a struggle against what they saw America becoming, as John has said, especially in Vietnam. That stage, it really starts in the late 50s with Germany's own war crimes trials, the Auschwitz and other trials. But it's a long, slow process, and we tend to, you know, compress the perspective as we look back.
Well, I think some of the notions Charlie just threw out are absolutely crucial. It perhaps took place a little more quickly in Japan. One is institution building. You must build the institutions. But the key is what Charlie referred to as inner democratization. It has to, you create the institutions in which the people themselves, this is democracy, can understand and build the structures of self-governance, democracy, rule of law, a better society. When I
dissent is part of that, too.
Dissent is a very strong part of that. You must liberate the people to give them the confidence that these are issues to struggle over, and it's a long struggle. But building the institutions, and in the case of Japan, and I think other places, the embracing that I used in my concept, embracing defeat, was embracing the opportunity to get greater control over your life in a freer society. It took enormous effort and input by the Japanese people. And it isn't a thing where you can hit and run. You just don't hit and run. Now, the Americans have a problem here because if they stay long, they're going to be seen as occupying force and a foreign alien oppressive presence. If they hit and run, what's going to happen then?
All right, Connection listeners, put away your stopwatches. Get out your calendars. This is going to take some time. John Darrow, thank you so much for coming in. John is a professor of Japanese history at MIT and author of Embracing Defeat, Japan in the Wake of World War II. Charlie Mayer, thank you so much for being with us. Charles Mayer is professor of European history at Harvard, author of Dissolution, The Crisis of Communism and the End of East Germany. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.